Today, we bring you a special regionally speaking on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Times Chief Political Reporter Dan Carden brings us the latest on politics locally as well as statewide in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Joseph Pete, a business reporter for the Times, looks at what will happen to the local economy as businesses slowly reopen. George Hamlin is the Director of Grants for Indiana Humanities. He joins us to discuss the more than $500,000 in funding relief available for organizations through the CARES Act. Plus, U.S. Representative Pete Visclosky recently joined Chris Nolte to talk about everything from how Congress is working to tackle concerns surrounding the coronavirus pandemic to Hoosier politics. All of that on this special edition of Regionally Speaking. But first, the news.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're checking in now with the latest on the COVID-19 pandemic here and the impact on Northwest Indiana and other issues. We have with us Dan Carden with the Times of Northwest Indiana to bring us up to date on some of the stories that he has put out there in print and online. And Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here. Okay.
Well, start out here with the latest from Governor Eric Holcomb concerning, relaxing some of the restrictions that we are still facing, at least for this week here in Northwest Indiana and Lake County in particular. Tell us about houses of worship and how things are likely to change for them.
Yeah, well, it's important to know the governor has launched a five-stage process for reopening the economy overall that, in theory, culminates with everything going back to normal by the 4th of July. There's a phased reopening of different parts of the state at different times. Different things can reopen at different times. For example, in Porter County and LaPorte County on Monday, retail shops that hadn't been deemed essential were able to open at 50% capacity. Shopping malls were able to open at 50% capacity. And more things will come online in subsequent weeks, so long as the number of coronavirus cases doesn't overwhelm the healthcare system. One of the things that kind of got an exception to that phased reopening are religious institutions or houses of worship, churches, synagogues, what have you. The governor is allowing all of those across the entire state to begin resuming normal services on Friday and obviously continuing through the weekend and subsequent weeks. He said he believed that churches more than businesses would be more likely to follow the social distancing guidelines and recommendations that are still out there for sanitation and other measures to try to minimize the spread of the coronavirus. So even though stores won't be, for example, reopening in Lake County until Monday, churches will be open at normal capacity starting this Sunday. Obviously, it's still up to each house of worship to decide if they want to open. The governor is also recommending that people over age 65, people who are sick, stay home, continue to watch online, or choose another way to fulfill their spiritual needs. But he admitted this is kind of an experiment or a test group to see how things will reopen in the coming months. And he said he picked churches again because he believes they're more likely to follow the rules. Mm.
I know that we've had our instances here in Lake County in particular where it seems that some groups didn't quite want to follow the rules. That was when they were strictly enforced. I wonder, with the relaxation here to this point, if we're going to see some more problems develop because some of these groups will be so anxious to reopen to have their services, and they won't think twice about having their large crowds come in.
Right. Well, again, they can have their large crowds. So even though other gatherings are limited to 25 people or 50 people, these churches are going to be able to have as many people as they want. And, it's just to see how this plays out. Theoretically, they're supposed to seat every other row. They're supposed to, sit together as families and not sit next to other people. They're supposed to stay apart from other people. It's recommended that they wear masks, but not required. So the governor said several times that this is a test case to see how this plays out. So I guess we'll see. Yeah.
One other story that you had in print and online out there that has happened because of the COVID-19 crisis. We know that the Indiana Democratic Party is going to have a virtual convention this year. And the story that you had out recently talks about how the Indiana Republicans have been thinking about the same. Bring us up to date on that.
Yeah, the Republicans have been more reluctant to switch to an online party convention, in part because they're going to have at least three candidates running for attorney general and possibly more. I'm sure most of your listeners know, only the governor nominee is chosen at this upcoming primary election. The other statewide offices are nominated at the convention.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a prerogative of the delegates to pick these people, and there's this tradition of glad handing and rallying your supporters at the convention and things like that that the Republican Party doesn't want to get rid of, and, especially because with more than two candidates, there has to be multiple rounds of voting. Usually, the person who gets the fewest votes is dropped from the ballot, and then there's another vote to decide who actually ends up with the nomination. Or if there's four candidates, there'd be at least three rounds of voting. So it's hard to do that in a mail-in ballot type format.
Mm-hmm.
They think they've come up with a way to do it. They've passed these temporary rules that they could use if they need to, that will use called ranked choice voting or instant runoff voting, where you rank the candidates. The person who gets the fewest first place votes still is dropped from the ballot, and then their votes are reassigned to whoever those people voted for, who named as their second choice. So it gets kind of complicated, but it may be what's needed if the party decides that they don't want to go ahead with an in-person convention.
Yeah, I know that you note in your story as well, too, that that there is a potential dark horse candidate, and maybe the virtual convention may be of advantage to him. Tell us about how we see that name, Todd Rokita, back in the news again.
Yeah, before everything shut down, Todd Rokita, Munster native, former congressman, former Indiana Secretary of State, was making the rounds at the Republican Lincoln Day dinners, these county party fundraisers all over the state, and it wasn't entirely clear why he would be doing that, since he's theoretically working in the private sector now after losing the 2018 Republican Senate primary. So there was some speculation then that he was eyeing the attorney general's race, and with Curtis Hill, his status as an attorney in question right now, given that he's got a pending disciplinary case before the Indiana Supreme Court that could force him to lose his law license and maybe give up his office. There's some speculation out there that Todd Rokita is eyeing this as a potential comeback move, and maybe as a prelude to a 2024 governor run. If you remember, in 2016, when Vice President Mike Pence, Governor Pence, was chosen to be vice president, he had to quit he had won the governor nomination for reelection, and the state party had to pick among three people to see who would fill that ballot slot. Obviously, it went to Governor Holcomb, but Todd Rokita is one of those people. So, he's been looking at that governor's office, presumably for a while, and maybe being attorney general is a good way in.
Hmm.
And in my story, I suggest that these ranked choice ballots, if they're needed for this virtual convention, would be helpful to him, because out of all the candidates besides Curtis Hill, he probably has the most name recognition among Republican convention delegates. He already won the Secretary of State nomination twice at the convention. I mean, it was a decade ago, but a lot of these people are still some of the same people. So I suggest he'd probably be in a good position to possibly win that nomination.
That's very, very possible, to be sure. We're talking with Dan Cardin with The Times about the stories he's put out in print and online recently. And one story that is not involved with COVID-19 or with Hoosier politics, at least we don't think directly anyway, is another story that we've talked about in other conversations in the past about Lake Michigan, in particular about property owned on Lake Michigan, lakefronts and the like. And we have another case where we have another, possibility of a challenge to a lawsuit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is the same case I wrote about maybe 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah.
These three property owners in the town of Porter filed a federal lawsuit hoping to overturn a 2018 Indiana Supreme Court decision that said the shoreline of Lake Michigan belongs to the state and always has. These people have no right to a private beach on Lake Michigan. So this was based on a 2018 Indiana Supreme Court ruling that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, that was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court didn't hear the case, so that doesn't set a precedent. So they were able to file a case in federal court in Hammond trying to overturn that Indiana Supreme Court ruling. During this past legislative session, the Indiana General Assembly took that Supreme Court ruling, you know, which has the force of law, but actually wrote it into state law and explicitly said private property owners with lake-adjacent property do not own the beach, they don't own the water, they don't have an exclusive right to use the beach, and the people of Indiana have the right to use the shoreline, the publicly owned portion of the shoreline, for, you know, all the traditional recreational uses for which they've been using it since, you know, Indiana became a state.
Mm-hmm.
What these people in Porter did was amend their lawsuit to now include a challenge to that statute as well, since it basically incorporated the Supreme Court decision into the law. So if they had prevailed in their original case, they would have had this interesting situation where they overturned the court ruling, but it was still in the law, so they would have had to file a new lawsuit. So what they've done is just amended their lawsuit to bring this new statute into the case as well.
Well, Dan, finally, we talk about a story here that has come up in the past. It's about an eastern Indiana man, a guy, I think he's from Marion, who owns a Land Rover, but unfortunately he's gotten in trouble with the authorities, and he lost possession of that vehicle. But now you have a story out, and the update on that talks about that he's going to get his vehicle back. We know that you have to read the story to get all the great details. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
I know if you try to talk about it, it's more confusing, or I should say it's less confusing if you read about it. Let's find out about it, though.
Yeah, so potentially he's going to get it back. The vehicle is seized as part of it's called civil forfeiture. You use your property in a crime, you actually don't even have to be convicted of the crime. The government can, in a sense, take your property from you, in this case a Land Rover, because the property has been tainted by the crime. That's the theory that they use. It's a civil procedure.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was busted for selling heroin to a police informant. They took his Land Rover. The Land Rover was worth $42,000. The maximum fine for selling heroin is $10,000. And the case, this case originally went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court to determine whether or not that was an excessive fine. Under the U.S. Constitution, the government isn't allowed to impose excessive fines. Indiana argued that only applied to the federal government. U.S. Supreme Court said no, it applies to states and localities as well. So now it's back in the trial. It came all the way back down to Indiana. It went back to the trial court, and the trial court judge said this was clearly an excessive fine because you took away this guy's only asset. You took away the vehicle he needs to have a job and go to his probation hearings, go to his drug treatment. But Attorney General Curtis Hill says, hey, this thing was still used in a crime, and we're going to try and keep it. So he has said, even though the trial court judge has said that this guy should get his Land Rover back, the Attorney General is trying to keep it on behalf of the state to send a message that civil forfeiture is one of the penalties you might face if you're dealing drugs in Indiana.
We'll just have to wait and see if A.G. Hill gets his way this time around. We'll find out, I guess, in the next story coming up here. Thanks to you, Dan Carton, for the information on that. A good mix of stories to talk about this time around. Appreciate it, and hope to have you back on again soon.
Anytime.
Dan Carton's a reporter, writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we're talking with Joseph Pete, who's the business writer and reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories he's put out there in print and online lately. And Joseph, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, let's take a look here about your story concerning the new start of an online marketplace to help Hoosier businesses, including those here in Northwest Indiana, get the PPEs that they need.
This week, the state of Indiana and the Indiana Economic Development Corporation launched a PPE marketplace, and the intent of it was to, since a lot of the Hoosier companies have switched over to manufacturing gloves or masks or hand sanitizer in the case of like 18th Street Distillery or Three Floyds. The intent of this is to help companies as they reopen and nonprofit small businesses to procure some of those items that some people have been having trouble finding on their own in the market. If you go to the Indiana Back on Track website, there's a link there, and you can place orders for these items on bulk. Small businesses with fewer than 150 employees or so, they're able to either order like a gallon drum of hand sanitizer, 2 ounce bottles of hand sanitizer, or bulk items of masks and gloves. You know, in some cases, under the governor's order, these are required to reopen. Restaurants, for instance, which are allowed to reopen in the state on Monday in the case of Porter, LaPorte, and most other counties, and on May 18th in the case of Lake County, which is takes longer because it's at a higher concentration of cases.
Yeah.
But workers there are required to wear face masks as part of the thing. And then many places are voluntarily, face masks are encouraged in a number of like workplace settings. And then, you know, a lot of the retailers have been having their workers wear face masks. Family Express out of Valpo, Walmart, Costco, and so on. They've been strongly, Menards, I believe, you know, a lot of the retailers are doing it, you know, voluntarily on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But smaller businesses, especially if they can't find it, can just go to the state website and place an order. For now, it's free. It might eventually cost something in the future. But it's a free service that the state is providing to kind of aid in its reopening plans.
I also know, too, that that they want to be sure that businesses realize that they want this as mainly as only a secondary source, not the primary source of PPE, since we know they're going to have to start getting them for a long time now.
Oh, absolutely. They managed to procure 9 million pieces of PPE, I believe they said.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've already distributed 4 million or so to healthcare workers. They said they were able to do this for two reasons, mainly. One is that they were able to procure enough, like, masks that were non-medical masks that, you know, can be used to protect people and stop the spread of disease, but are not used by frontline medical workers. And then also because Hoosier companies were able to manufacture enough hand sanitizer to that there was a surplus that they were able to start distributing.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave what they needed to the medical and other essential workers, and now they're distributing it across the to small businesses across the state to just aid in the return to work, getting back on track mm-hmm. effort.
Some of the other stories that you've had related to the pandemic and focusing in on reopening, one in particular is about the businesses in Northwest Indiana and restaurants and some of the stores and the like. And another story you have, and we'll take up as well, too, is about the casinos. Let's deal first with the restaurants and the stores. Tell us about your story there and what you've learned about the reopening process for them.
Well, the state, Governor Holcomb has put out like a very detailed and gradual and phased-in plan that is aiming for, you know, to have most everything open by July 4th, Independence Day, a pretty symbolic date, obviously. But it's staggered in that, you know, you're allowed to, it's a very staggered recovery. You know, certain things like mass gatherings aren't allowed till much later. Places like gyms and so forth aren't allowed until much later. But initially, right off the bat, on Monday, much of the state was allowed to reopen, except specifically for Marion, Cass, and Lake counties, which have had a higher incidence of cases. In the case of Lake and Marion, it's due to their size and population density. In the case of Cass, it's because they have a meat processing plant where they had a large outbreak of cases. The conditions there, workers are working elbow to elbow. It's hard, almost impossible to practice, you know, social distancing. It's a very tight, you know, tight environment where it's very, very difficult to stop the spread of the disease. So you've had more than 5,000 meat workers infected nationwide, more than 20 deaths so far, which is why you've had 22 of those plants closed, and you're seeing the widespread meat shortages. They're even asking, like, where's the beef at? Wendy's, where one of out of five restaurants is out of hamburgers, and something that would seem almost unthinkable. But at the state, under the state's guidance, the most retail businesses were allowed to reopen on Monday in Northwest Indiana. You know, in Porter, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper, Stark, Pulaski counties, the retail businesses were able to open Monday. Restaurants will be allowed. There's been a lot of confusion over this because of the way it was rolled out. But restaurants, under the state's order, are not legally allowed to reopen until next Monday, because it's the way it works is you enter stage two, and then a week later the restaurants can come online.
Yeah.
So in the case of Porter, LaPorte, Jasper, Newton, Pulaski, Stark counties, and most of the rest of Indiana, restaurants are able to open Monday at 50% capacity with employees wearing masks, and they have to either take half the tables out of commission by physically removing them or taping them off or whatever, you know, whatever they choose. But they need to, you know, encourage the practicing of social distancing. And then in the case of Lake County, it's a week behind everybody else because of the higher concentration of cases. In Lake County, retail businesses are non-essential ones that don't serve food, basically. That's the big difference.
Yeah.
They're allowed to reopen next Monday on May 11th. And the restaurants are allowed to open a week later. There's been just a lot, just the way the plan is. The details are included in the fine print. We've been over it again and again with the governor's office. But I've talked to a lot of restaurant owners that are very confused by the way the state is expressing these orders. But the governor's office, the way it's set up, is regular businesses in Lake County can open on May 11th. And on the May 18th, 1 week later, the restaurants in Lake County can then reopen at half capacity. And then it's staggered. It's basically Lake and Marion are a week behind everybody else.
Yeah.
I think it's even further out in the case of Cass County.
I see.
But it's May 18th. The governor's office has been clear on this with us and with other media outlets that the restaurants can open at 50% capacity. But there's just been the way, as detailed and detailed and specific as the order is, a lot of business owners have been focusing on the big dates that have been announced, but the thing is, it's clearly stated in the plan and in the state's website and everything that it's, as far as the way it rolls out, is in stage two. Restaurants can't open until a week until the county enters two. Lake County enters stage two on Monday, so it'll be another week before the restaurants are allowed back.
That sounds a bit confusing. It's probably even more confusing for the restaurateurs, I imagine. They probably do, and maybe in a way, have appreciated this extra week because they're probably still trying to figure out how they're going to be able to follow the guidelines in some cases.
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of logistics to work out. They've got to get their employees back to work. They have to clean their restaurants and get them ready. There are now difficulties procuring meats in a lot of places, a lot of the traditional meat sources. I talked to restaurant owners that, you know, like a coffee shop that used all the boar-fed meat typically, now it's almost impossible to come by. There's a pizza place that they've had trouble, you know, getting almost every type of meat they, you know, normally use. So that's going to be an additional challenge for them. But then they have to figure out what they're going to do with the dining and seating because the state's requirement is it be at 50% capacity. So they're telling people either remove the tables and the chairs, you know, just use half of what you normally use, and or tape them off so they're clearly out of commission so that people aren't, you know, sitting kind of elbow to elbow with each other. And then a lot of the businesses I've talked to are going to continue to offer, contactless delivery, curbside pickup, and so on. They're going to keep doing that at least until they're allowed to reopen at 100% capacity, which is will not be for a while yet. The way the plan works is it's gradually phased in. After a while, they can go to 75% capacity, and then after a while after that, they can finally go back to full 100% capacity. And that'll be critical for restaurants in particular, because one thing restaurant owners have pointed out is like people think like that just because it's busy or whatever, they're making like tons of money. But in reality, most food businesses, whether retail, supermarkets, or restaurants, they're usually looking at pretty razor-thin margins. It's much thinner margins than a lot of other businesses just because, you know, you're dealing with a lot of fresh inventory that can expire. You have high labor costs. You know, it's not the most – restaurants are not the most profitable venture to get into. They've been trying to get by just on the carry-out and delivery, and most of them are going to continue to offer the carry-out and delivery until they're allowed to, like, fully reopen their doors. Right. If it is deemed safe to do so.
Okay. Joseph, let's talk now a little bit about the casinos. One of your stories that you had out there in print and online in the Times goes into the fact that the employees of the casinos around Northwest Indiana in particular and around the rest of the state have gone out there. They've rallied really hard to make sure that the owners of the casinos make it safe for them to work and make it safe for the patrons to come back to be able to gamble. Tell us about the concerns that the union employees have about the cleanliness and the safety of the casinos when they do open up in June.
Yes, the Unite Here union held a virtual rally all over the state on Facebook and, you know, so forth on last Friday, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But they were urging the casinos, including ones in Northwest Indiana, to please, make it safe to reopen. Their particular areas of concern was that they wanted to see more cleaning, more safety measures, more protocols as to how they're going to be keeping both the employees and the workers safe and sanitizing the workplace environments. And they're also calling for better health care to take care of them if they do get sick. They're wanting to make sure the health care was affordable for all workers and they would be able to, if they're going to be asked to come out and risk their lives to work there, that they'd be able to get the, you know, health care they need affordably, and that a lot of these casinos, take steps to make their workplaces safer. It pointed out that they generally do have the revenue to do so. Majestic Star, the Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, Ameristar, the Ameristar owner, Penn National Gaming, pulled in $5.3 billion in revenue last year, which was an all-time record for it. The Ameristar, Blue Chip in Michigan City, Caesars Southern Indiana, Indiana Grand, and Majestic Star, they collectively generated $66.4 million in tax revenue during just the first 3 months of the year. So the casinos are doing well, and it was actually a pretty good boom time for them prior to this because they were rolling out the sports wagering, so they were seeing all-time kind of records in terms of revenue, as there was a lot of interest in that. However, obviously, the coronavirus pandemic put a stop to most sports. I think my colleague Dan Carden has done excellent stories about how the only thing they can wager on now online is like Ukrainian ping pong or Russian.
That's
ping pong.
Right. Yeah,
it's a pretty sparse environment for that. Although both the Major League Baseball and the NBA are in discussions with the players' unions about bringing sports back, potentially in empty stadiums and so forth. But it's they were seeing all kinds of record revenues from the sports wagering, and then everything, the world is completely ground to a halt because of the deadly virus that's killed over, like, 74,000 Americans and more than, I believe, 265,000 people worldwide thus far.
Yeah.
And it keeps growing by thousands of people every day.
Well, Joe, I'll tell you, this has been a unique time to do a series of reports on how Northwest Indiana businesses run or keep running, if the case may be. And we appreciate you spending all the time and doing the research and putting the stories out there in print and online. And I'm sure there'll be many more to come. So we will have had a chance to have you back on to talk again soon. Thank you very much, Joe, for being with us today to bring us up to date on many of the stories, most of them coronavirus related, that you've had out in print and online today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joseph Pete is a business writer and reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Congressman Pete Sosnowski has been very busy. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, he's been back here in Northwest Indiana, of course, since the House of Representatives is on recess because of the pandemic. But he's been busy while he's been home, and we've had a chance to catch up with him to find out what he has been doing lately and covering issues, which, of course, range from the pandemic and how we're trying to help deal with it, to Hoosier politics. Here's our conversation. If you will cover some of the points that you mentioned here in your report concerning the pandemic from this last week, bring us up to date on the work on the small business assistance that's still needed and whatever measures that you see that the House is going to take up here as they continue to deal with the pandemic.
Yeah, we remain very concerned about the issue of small businesses, both in places like Northwest Indiana, whether they might be a restaurant, public service, but also looking ahead to the people who do contracts with the United States government. I chair the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, for example, and I don't want to be dismissive, but Lockheed Martin will always be taking care of themselves. It's that distributor and Tier 3 and 4 provider that we're very concerned about, making sure that they can be economically viable going forward. So we are looking essentially for a fourth iteration as far as assistance for small businesses and to begin that economic recovery. It's impossible to project today exactly when that will be considered. My sense is probably within the next 2 weeks.
Okay. What's the status, you think, as far as another stimulus check program going out again? I know for a lot of people still haven't gotten their first ones that are out. That's happening now, but I know there's a discussion about the possibility of maybe another measure that may come along the way.
There's been discussion, but I would not want to raise expectations at this time given the uncertainty of that issue.
Okay. I know the main concern is making sure that that SNAP benefits and the like for people that need to have the additional supplement to feed their families and keep themselves going is all part of it, too.
Yeah, we really are. And one of the things, again, on our subcommittee in particular, because our focus is on defense, but each of our subcommittees are doing the same thing, is who is dependent upon this type of assistance. And while people making the distribution may suggest everything is fine, let's make some calls to those people further down the system. How is it working today? We cannot change any of the legislation we have passed to date. But going forward, if problems persist as far as those monies getting to people who need it the most, we ought to be able to fix that in the next tranche of legislation.
I know that in the House they've talked about efforts to try to implement some enhanced workplace health and safety rules. How do things stand on that?
That is a work in progress. I would point out that one of the 11 subcommittees on the Appropriations Committee, in which I serve, is going to hold a virtual hearing this week. It'll be the second attempt in the House to see how that process works. So, again, you make sure that you have that social distancing. In the District of Columbia, you see cases continuing to increase. In the state of Maryland, cases increase. I have instructed my staff, whether we're in session this coming week or not, that they should not return physically to their work in D.C. until that closure is lifted. Obviously, for so much of what we do, we can do it electronically and in conference calls. But the first point of departure here, whether it's House employees, that person living in Gary, Indiana, or Lowell, don't get sick. Be healthy. Because if we don't contain the pandemic, we're never going to enjoy a successful economic recovery. To piecemeal this and ignore the health problem that got us in this situation in the first place would be a fundamental mistake.
Do you think that unfortunately the COVID-19 crisis that we're all still in here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular, it has made things a little bit more difficult than perhaps maybe 6 months ago you had thought?
Very much so, and so much of the electoral process is interacting with people, and obviously people are going to have to be very ingenious and aggressive in how they do that in a safe, viable fashion. What I would simply do is indicate that as citizens, we do have privileges in society, but we have responsibilities. And one of them is to judge candidates running for offices, whether they be county, whether they be state or federal, and then act on that judgment and vote. We have an election for both parties, primaries, on June 2nd. I would encourage everyone, regardless of their party, regardless of their persuasion, or the candidates who they support, to please apply for that absentee ballot. Please send that in. Don't leave it to chance, because in Indiana we will have only 1 week of early voting, and then you have Election Day on June 2nd. Very concerned about turnout because of the health crisis. There is a way to vote safely, and that is absentee. So again, I encourage everyone listening to this to please get that ballot and please exercise your right to vote.
Let's turn to the Hoosier politics. I know that you've had some thoughts about how the Indiana State Democratic Party is going to do the convention this time around, a little different than we know in the past. It's going virtual. What are your thoughts about that? And in particular, maybe urging Democrats to support the candidate for president.
Yeah. I appreciate that the state party is looking to make sure, again, everyone is in good health, but that democratic process continues, because we have a very important election this fall. So I certainly support what they are doing. As far as the ticket, I have endorsed Vice President Biden for president. I have also indicated at the state level that I support State Senator Karen Tallien, who I have an immense respect for the position of Attorney General in Indiana. I myself will not be an active participant since I'm not a statewide candidate or a candidate at all. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I am not a delegate to the state convention, but certainly would encourage those who are to support her candidacy. Okay.
Let's take a couple minutes and take a look at the future. Although I know there's nothing that is very set in stone, so to speak, about what your plans are after the end of the calendar year and you step down from your office in the Indiana, the U.S. House of Representatives, come back to Indiana with hope. What are your thoughts about what you want to do after the term of office ends and you turn things over to your successor?
What I tell people is I was born in Gary, Indiana. I live in Gary, Indiana today. This is my home. I graduated from college in Gary, Indiana. As far as plans, I indicate to people that I still have a job to do for 8 months, and I'm very serious about that, to make sure some of these transformational investments we worked on, like the South Shore, are completed, that my committee work is done properly. But looking ahead, I would simply tell you that the joke in our family is that I will die before I read all the books I have bought. I tell people I will die trying to do that. What else the future holds right now, I just wouldn't want to speculate.
Have you thought or have you been approached by anybody about joining some of your colleagues who have stepped down from public office and gone into academia?
At this point, I have an open mind, but again, much more focused on the next 8 months of my job responsibility. I say one of the very nice things about the way this has happened, I have 14 months to let it wash over me, see what opportunities are out there, and then make my own personal choice. But at this point, I have a job to do.
Congressman Visosky, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk today, and glad to see that you're safe and well, and hope you stay that way.
And I hope everyone else, again, exercises great caution and continues in good health as well.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link.